Madame immediately turned her broad, painted face toward him, at first looking displeased but quickly dissolving into a professional smile. "Ha!" she boomed. "Mr. Noonan himself missed the girls?" Benny continued to gobble. He was deaf as a post. "Hello, old lady," replied Noonan, approaching. "What do I need with girls when I have a real woman in front of me?" Benny finally noticed him. His hideous mug, crisscrossed with red and blue scars, contorted with effort into a welcoming smile. "Hello, boss," he wheezed. "Come in to dry off?" Noonan smiled in response and waved his hand. He didn't like talking to Benny. He always had to holler. "Where's my manager, guys?" he asked. "In his office," replied the madam. "Tomorrow is tax day." "Oh, those taxes," said Noonan. "All right, madam, fix me my favorite drink. I'll be right back." Silently stepping on the thick synthetic carpet, he walked along the hallway past the curtain-covered stalls. The walls by the stalls were decorated with pictures of various flowers, turned into an unremarkable cul-de-sac, and, without knocking, opened the leather-covered door. Hamfist Kitty was sitting behind the desk and examining an evil-looking sore on his nose in a mirror. He couldn't care less that tomorrow was tax day. The surface in front of him held only a jar of mercury ointment and a glass of some see-through liquid. Hamfist Kitty raised his bloodshot eyes at Noonan and leaped up, dropping the mirror. Without saying a word, Noonan lowered himself into the armchair across from him and spent a while silently scrutinizing the rascal and listening as he mumbled something incoherent about the damn rain and his rheumatism. Then Noonan said, "Please lock the door, pal." Hamfist, stomping his huge flat feet, ran to the door, turned the key, and came back to the desk. He towered like a hairy mountain over Noonan, staring devotedly at his mouth. Noonan kept examining him through screwed-up eyes. For some reason, he suddenly remembered that Hamfist Kitty's real name was Raphael. The nickname Hamfist came from his monstrous bony fists, bluish-red and bare, that protruded from the thick fur covering his arms as if from a pair of sleeves. And he named himself Kitty, in complete confidence that this was the traditional name of the great Mongolian kings, Raphael. "Well, Raphael, let us begin." "How are things?" Noonan asked affectionately. "In perfect order, boss," Raphael Hamfist answered hastily. "Did you patch up the scandal at headquarters?" "Put down $150, everyone is happy." "That's $150 from your pocket," said Noonan. "That was your fault, pal. Should have kept an eye on it." Hamfist made a miserable face and spread his huge hands in submission. "The hardwood floor in the lobby should be replaced," said Noonan.
"Will do."
Noonan paused, pursing his lips. "Any swag?" he asked, lowering his voice.
"There's some," said Hamfist, also lowering his voice.
"Show me." Hamfist darted to the safe, took out a package, placed it on the desk in front of Noonan, and unwrapped it. Noonan poked a finger into the pile of black sparks, picked up a bracelet, examined it from every side, and put it back.
"Is that it?" he asked.
"They don't bring any," Hamfist said guiltily.
"They don't bring any," repeated Noonan. He took careful aim and kicked Hamfist's shin as hard as he could with the toe of his shoe. Hamfist moaned and started to bend over to grab the injured leg, but immediately drew himself up and stood at attention. Then Noonan leaped up, as if someone had jabbed him in the ass, kicked aside the armchair, grabbed Hamfist by the collar of his shirt, and went at him, kicking, rolling his eyes, and whispering obscenities. Hamfist, grasping and moaning and rearing his head like a frightened horse, backed away from him until he collapsed onto the couch.
"Working both sides, bastard," hissed Noonan right into his eyes, which were white with terror. "Burbage is swimming in swag, and you bring me little beads wrapped in paper?"
He turned around and smacked Hamfist in the face, taking care to hit the sower on his nose.
"I'll have you rot in jail. You'll be living in shit, eating shit. You'll curse the day you were born," He took another hard jab at the sower. How is Burbridge getting swag? Why did they bring it to him and not to you? Who brings it? Why don't you know anything? Who are you working for, you hairy pig? Tell me!
Hamfist opened and closed his mouth like a fish. Noonan let him go, returned to the armchair, and put his feet up on the desk.
Well, he said.
Hamfist noisily sucked the blood in through his nose and said, Really, boss, what's going on? What swag does a vulture have? He doesn't have any swag. Nowadays, no one has swag.
You're going to argue with me? Noonan asked with seeming affection, taking his feet off the desk.
No, no, boss, I swear, said Hamfist hastily. Honest to God, argue with you? I never even considered it.
I'll get rid of you, said Noonan gloomily, because either you've sold out or you don't know how to work. What the hell do I need you for, you lazy bum? I could get dozens like you. I need a real man for the job, and all you do is ruin the girls and guzzle beer.
Wait a minute, boss, argued Hamfist, smearing blood around his face. Why attack me all of a sudden? Let's try to get this straight.
He gingerly felt the sower with his fingertips. Burbridge has lots of swag, you say?
I don't know about that. I apologize, of course, but someone's been pulling your leg. No one has any swag nowadays. It's only the raw kids that go into the zone, and they almost never come back. No, boss, I swear, someone's pulling your leg.
Noonan was watching him out of the corner of his eye. It seemed that Hamfist really didn't know a thing. Anyway, wasn't worth his while to lie. The vulture didn't pay well.
These picnics of his, are they profitable? He asked.
The picnics, not very. He isn't shoveling it in. But then there's no profitable work left in town.
Where are these picnics held?
Were they held?
At various places, at the White Mountain, at the Hot Springs, by the Rainbow Lakes.
And who are his clients?
His clients?
Hamfist felt his sore again, glanced at his fingers, and spoke confidently.
Boss, if you're thinking of getting into that business, I'd advise against it. You can't compete with the vulture.
Why not?
It's his clients. He has the police. That's one. Hamfist was counting on his fingers. The officers from headquarters, that's two. Tourists from the Metropole, White Lily and the Alien, that's three. And his advertising is good. The locals use him, too. I swear, boss, it wouldn't be worth it to get involved. And he pays us for the girls, if not that generously.
The locals use him, too?
Young men, mostly.
And what do you do there at the picnics?
What do we do? We go there by bus, see? They already have the tents, food, and music set up. Then everyone amuses themselves. The officers mostly enjoy the girls. Tourists troop off to see the zone. When it's at the Hot Springs, the zone is a stone's throw away, right over the Sulphur Gorge. The vultures scattered horse bones over there for them, so they look at them through binoculars.
And the locals?
The locals, of course, aren't interested in that. They amuse themselves.
And Burbridge?
What about Burbridge?
Burbridge is like everyone else.
And you?
What about me? I'm like everyone else. I make sure no one's bothering the girls, and,
anyway, I'm like everyone else.
And how long do these things last?
It varies. Sometimes 3 days, sometimes a whole week.
And how much does this pleasure trip cost? Asked Noonan, now thinking about something else entirely.
Hamfist said something, but Noonan didn't hear him.
There it is. I oversight, he thought. A couple of days, a couple of nights. Under these circumstances, it would be simply impossible to keep track of Burbridge, even if you were completely focused on doing so and weren't busy cavorting with the girls and guzzling beer like my Mongolian king. But I'm still missing something. He's legless, and there's a gorge. No, something's off.
Which locals come frequently?
Locals. As I said, mostly young men, the hoodlums of the town. Like, say, Halavi, Rajba, Zapfa the Chicken, and what's his name, Zmig. Sometimes the Maltese, A tight-knit crowd. They call it Sunday school. Let's go to Sunday school, they say. They're mostly in it for the women tourists. That's easy money for them. Say, an old lady from Europe shows up. Sunday school, Noonan repeated. A strange thought suddenly occurred to him. School. He got up. All right, he said. The hell with these picnics. That's not for us. What you need to know is that the vulture has swag. That's our business, pal. That we simply can't allow. Keep looking, Hamfist. Keep looking, or you'll be out on your ass. Figure out where he gets the swag and who supplies it to him. Then beat him by 20%. Got it? Got it, boss. Hamfist was already standing at attention, devotion on his blood-smeared mug. And stop ruining the girls, you animal, Noonan roared, and left. Standing at the bar in the hall, he leisurely sipped his aperitif, chatted with the madam about the decline in morality, and hinted that in the very near future he was planning to expand the establishment. Lowering his voice for effect, he consulted her on what to do about Benny. The guy's getting old. His hearing is almost gone. His reaction time is shot. He can't manage like before. It was already 6 o'clock. He was getting hungry. But that same unexpected thought kept boring and twisting through his brain. A strange, incongruous thought that nevertheless explained a lot. But in any case, much had already been explained. The business had been stripped of its irritating and frightening aura of mysticism, and all that remained was chagrin that he didn't think of this before. But that wasn't the important thing. The important thing was the thought that kept spinning and twisting through his brain and wouldn't let him rest. After he said goodbye to the madam and shook Benny's hand, Noonan drove straight to the Borscht. The problem is, we don't notice the years pass, he thought. Screw the years. We don't notice things change. We know that things change. We've been told since childhood that things change. We witness things change, ourselves many a time, and yet we're still utterly incapable of noticing the moment the change comes. Well, we search for change in all the wrong places. A new breed of stalker has appeared, armed with technology. The old stalker was a sullen, dirty man, stubborn as a mule, crawling through the zone inch by inch on his stomach, earning his keep. The new stalker is a tie-wearing dandy, an engineer, somewhere a mile away from the zone, a cigarette in his teeth, a cocktail by his elbow, sitting and watching the monitors, a salaried gentleman, a very logical picture, so logical that other possibilities don't even occur. And yet, there are other possibilities. Sunday school, for one. Suddenly, for no apparent reason, he felt a wave of despair. Everything was useless. Everything was pointless. My God, he thought, we can't do a thing. We can't stop it. We can't slow it down. No force in the world could contain this blight, he thought in horror. It's not because we do bad work, and it's not because they are more clever and cunning than we are. The world is just like that. Man is like that. If it wasn't the visit, it would have been something else. Pigs can always find mud. The Borscht was brightly lit and full of delicious smells. The Borscht had also changed. No more boozing and no more merrymaking. Gutlin didn't come here anymore, turned up his nose, and Red Shoehart had probably stuck his freckled mug inside, scowled, and went off. Ernest was still in jail. His old lady was enjoying being in charge. There was a steady, respectable clientele. The whole institute came here for lunch, as did the senior officers. The booths were cozy. The food was tasty. The prices were moderate. The beer was always fresh. A good old-fashioned pub. Noonan saw Valentine Pillman sitting in one of the booths. The Nobel laureate was drinking coffee and reading a magazine folded in half. Noonan approached. "May I join you?" he asked.
Valentine raised his dark glasses at him. Ah, he said. Feel free.
1 second, let me wash my hands, said Noonan, remembering the sower. He was well known here. When he came back and sat down across from Valentine, there was already a small grill with sizzling barbecue and a tall stein of beer on the table, neither warm nor cold, just the way he liked it. Valentine put the magazine down and took a sip of coffee.
Listen, Valentine, said Noonan, cutting a piece of meat and dipping it in the sauce. How do you think it's all going to end?
What are you talking about?
The visit. Zones, stalkers, military-industrial complexes, the whole stinking mess. How could it all end?
For a long time, Valentine stared at him through his opaque black lenses. Then he lit up a cigarette and said,
For whom? Be more specific.
Well, say for humanity as a whole.
That depends on our luck, said Valentine. We now know that for humanity as a whole, the visit has largely passed without a trace. For humanity, everything passes without a trace. Of course, it's possible that by randomly pulling chestnuts out of this fire, we'll eventually stumble on something that will make life on Earth completely unbearable. That would be bad luck. But you have to admit, that's a danger humanity has always faced. He waved away the cigarette smoke and smiled wryly. You see, I've long since become unused to discussing humanity as a whole. Humanity as a whole is too stable a system. Nothing upsets it.
You think so? Said Noonan with disappointment.
Well, that may be. Tell me the truth, Richard, said Valentine, obviously amusing himself. What changed for you, a businessman, after the visit? So you've learned that the universe contains at least one intelligent species other than man. So what?
How can I put it? Mumbled Richard. He was already sorry that he started the subject. There was nothing to say here.
What changed for me? For example, for many years now I've been feeling a bit uneasy, apprehensive. All right, so they came and left immediately, and what if they come back and decide to stay? For me, a businessman, these aren't idle questions. You know, who they are, how they live, what they need. In the most primitive case, I'm forced to consider how to modify my product. I have to be ready. And what if I turn out to be completely superfluous in their society? He became more animated.
What if we're all superfluous? Listen, Valentine, since we're on the subject, are there answers to these questions? Who they are, what they wanted, if they'll come back?
There are answers, said Valentine, with an ironic smile. Lots of them. Pick any you like.
And what do you think?
To be honest, I've never let myself seriously consider it. For me, the visit is first and foremost a unique event that could potentially allow us to skip a few rungs in the ladder of progress, like a trip into the future of technology. Say, like Isaac Newton finding a modern microwave emitter in his laboratory.
Newton wouldn't have understood a thing.
You'd be surprised. Newton was a very smart man.
Oh, yeah?
Anyway, never mind Newton. What do you actually think about the visit, even if not seriously?
Fine, I'll tell you. But I have to warn you, Richard, that your question falls under the umbrella of a pseudoscience called xenology. Xenology is an unnatural mixture of science fiction and formal logic. At its core is a flawed assumption that an alien race would be psychologically human.
Why flawed? Asked Noonan.
Because biologists have already been burned attempting to apply human psychology to animals. Earth animals, I note.
Just a second, said Noonan. That's totally different. We're talking about the psychology of intelligent beings.
True, and that would be just fine if we knew what intelligence was.
And we don't? Asked Noonan in surprise.
Believe it or not, we don't. We usually proceed from a trivial definition. Intelligence is the attribute of man that separates his activity from that of the animals.
It's a kind of attempt to distinguish the master from his dog, who seems to understand everything but can't speak. However, this trivial definition does lead to wittier ones. They are based on depressing observations of the aforementioned human activity. For example, intelligence is the ability of a living creature to perform pointless or unnatural acts.
Yes, that's us, agreed Noonan.
Unfortunately. Or there's a definition hypothesis. Intelligence is a complex instinct which hasn't yet fully matured. The idea is that instinctive activity is always natural and useful. A million years will pass, the instinct will mature, and we will cease making the mistakes, which are probably an integral part of intelligence. And then, if anything in the universe changes, we will happily become extinct. Again, precisely because we've lost the art of making mistakes, that is, trying various things not prescribed by a rigid code.
Somehow this all sounds so demeaning.
All right, then, here's another definition, a very lofty and noble one. Intelligence is the ability to harness the powers of the surrounding world without destroying the said world.
Noonan grimaced and shook his head. No, he said. That's a bit much. That's not us.
Well, how about the idea that humans, unlike animals, have an overpowering need for knowledge? I read that somewhere.
So have I, said Valentine.
But the issue is that man, at least the average man, can easily overcome this need. In my opinion, the need doesn't exist at all. There is a need to understand, but that doesn't require knowledge. The God hypothesis, for example, allows you to have an unparalleled understanding of absolutely everything while knowing absolutely nothing. Give a man a highly simplified model of the world and interpret every event on the basis of this simple model. This approach requires no knowledge. A few rote formulas, plus some so-called intuition, some so-called practical acumen, and some so-called common sense.
Wait, said Noonan. He finished his beer and banged the empty stein down on the table. Don't get off track. Let's put it this way. A man meets an alien. How does each figure out that the other is intelligent?
No idea, Valentine said merrily. All I've read on the subject reduces it to a vicious circle. If they are capable of contact, then they are intelligent. And conversely, if they are intelligent, then they are capable of contact. And in general, if an alien creature has the honor of being psychologically human, then it's intelligent. That's how it is, Richard. Read Vonnegut?
Damn it, said Noonan.
And here I thought you'd sorted everything out.
Even a monkey can sort things, observed Valentine.
Now wait, said Noonan. For some reason he felt cheated. But if you don't even know such simple things... All right, never mind intelligence. Looks like there's no making heads or tails of it, but about the visit. What do you think about the visit?
Certainly, said Valentine.
Imagine a picnic.
Noonan jumped.
What did you say?
A picnic. Imagine a forest, a country road, a meadow. A car pulls off the road into the meadow and unloads young men, bottles, picnic baskets, girls, transistor radios, cameras. A fire is lit, tents are pitched, music is played, and in the morning they leave. The animals, birds, and insects that were watching the whole night in horror crawl out of their shelters. And what do they see? An oil spill, a gasoline puddle, old spark plugs and oil filters strewn about, scattered rags, burnt-out bulbs, someone has dropped a monkey wrench. The wheels have tracked mud from some godforsaken swamp. And, of course, there are the remains of the campfire, apple cores, candy wrappers, tins, bottles, someone's handkerchief, someone's penknife. Old ragged newspapers, coins, wilted flowers from another meadow. I get it, said Noonan. A roadside picnic.
Exactly. A picnic by the side of some space road. And you ask me whether they'll come back.
Let me have a smoke, said Noonan. Damn your pseudoscience. Somehow this isn't at all how I envisioned it.
That's your right, observed Valentine.
What? You mean they never even noticed us?
Why?
Or at least they paid no attention.
I wouldn't get too disappointed if I were you, advised Valentine.
Noonan took a drag, coughed, and threw the cigarette down.
All the same, he said stubbornly, it couldn't be. Damn you, scientist! Where do you get this disdain for man? Why do you constantly need to put him down?
Wait, said Valentine, listen. You ask what makes man great, he quoted. Is it that he recreated nature, that he harnessed forces of almost cosmic proportions, that in a brief time he has conquered the planet and opened a window onto the universe? No. It is that despite all this, he has survived and intends to continue doing so.
There was silence. Noonan was thinking.
Maybe, he said uncertainly. Of course, from that point of view...
Don't get so upset, Valentine said kindly. The picnic is only my hypothesis. And not even a hypothesis, really, but an impression. So-called serious xenologists try to justify interpretations that are much more respectable and flattering to human vanity. For example, that the visit hasn't happened yet, that... The real visit is yet to come. Some higher intelligence came to Earth and left us containers with samples of their material culture. They expect us to study these samples and make a technological leap, enabling us to send back a signal indicating we're truly ready for contact. How's that?
That's much better, said Noonan. I see that even among the scientists there are decent men.
Or here's another one. The visit did take place, but it is by no means over. We're actually in contact as we speak. We just don't know it. The aliens are holed up in the zones and are carefully studying us, simultaneously preparing us for the time of cruel miracles.
Now, that I understand, said Noonan. At least it explains the mysterious bustle in the ruins of the factory. By the way, your picnic doesn't account for that.
Why not? Disagreed Valentine. Some little girl might have dropped her favorite wind-up doll.
Now cut that out, said Noonan emphatically. Some doll? The ground is shaken.
Then again, of course, it could be a doll.
Want some beer? Rosalie, come here, old lady. Two beers for the xenologists.
It really is a pleasure to talk to you, he told Valentine. A real brain cleansing, like someone poured Epsom salts under my skull. Otherwise you work and work, but you never think about why or what for, or grapple with what might happen, try to lighten your load.
They brought the beer. Noonan took a sip and, looking over the foam, saw Valentine with an expression of fastidious skepticism, examining his stein.
What, you don't like it? He asked, licking his lips.
To be honest, I don't drink, said Valentine with hesitation.
Oh, yeah? Said Noonan in astonishment.
Damn it, said Valentine. There has to be one non-drinker in the world. He decisively pushed the stein away.
Order me a cognac, then, he said.
Rosalie, Noonan shouted immediately, now completely mellow. When they brought the cognac, Noonan said,
Still, it's not right. I won't even mention your picnic. That's a complete disgrace. But even accepting the hypothesis that this is, say, a... prelude to contact. It's still no good. Bracelets, empties. Those I could understand, but why the slime? Or the bug traps, or that disgusting fuzz?
Excuse me, said Valentine, choosing a slice of lemon. I don't exactly understand your terminology.
What traps?
Noonan laughed. That's folklore, he explained. Stalker's jargon. Bug traps. Those are the areas of increased gravity.
Oh, the graviconcentrates, directed gravity.
Now that's something I would enjoy discussing, but you wouldn't understand a thing. Why not? I'm an engineer, after all. Because I don't understand a thing myself. I have a system of equations, but I haven't a notion how to interpret it. And the slime, that's probably the colloidal gas. The very same. You heard about the catastrophe in the Kerrigan labs?
I've heard something, Valentine replied reluctantly.
Those idiots placed a porcelain container with the slime into a special maximally insulated chamber. That is, they thought that it was maximally insulated, but when they opened the container with the mechanical arm, the slime went through the metal and plastic like water through a sieve, escaped, and turned everything it touched into the same slime. The tally, 35 dead, more than 100 injured, and the entire laboratory is completely unusable. Have you ever been there? It's a gorgeous building, and now slime is seeped into the basement and lower floors. That's a prelude to contact for you.
Valentine made a face. Yes, I know all that, he said. But you have to admit, Richard, that the aliens had nothing to do with this. How could they have known about the existence of military-industrial complexes?
Well, they should have known, said Noonan didactically.
And here's what they'd say in reply. You should have long since gotten rid of military-industrial complexes.
That's fair, agreed Noonan. Maybe that's what they should have worked on, if they're so powerful.
So, you're suggesting interference with the internal affairs of mankind?
Said Noonan. That, of course, could lead us all sorts of places. Forget about it. Let's return to the beginning of the conversation. How is it all going to end? Say, take you scientists. Are you hoping to acquire something fundamental from the zone, something that could really revolutionize our science, technology, way of life?
Valentine finished his drink and shrugged his shoulders.
You're talking to the wrong man, Richard. I don't like empty fantasies. When it comes to such a serious subject, I prefer cautious skepticism. Judging from what we've already acquired, there is a whole spectrum of possibilities and nothing definite can be said.
Rosalie, more cognac, yelled Noonan.
Well, all right. Let's try another tack. What, in your opinion, have we already acquired?
Amusingly enough, very little. We found many marvels. In a number of cases, we've even learned how to adapt these marvels to our needs. We've even gotten used to them. A lab monkey presses a red button and gets a banana, presses a white button and gets an orange, but has no idea how to obtain bananas or oranges without buttons. Nor does it understand the relationship between buttons and oranges and bananas. Take, say, the spacels. We've learned to apply them. We've even discovered conditions under which they multiply by division. But we have yet to create a single spacel. Have no idea how they work, and as far as I can tell, won't figure it out anytime soon. Here's what I'd say. There are a number of objects for which we have found applications. We use them, although almost certainly not in the ways that the aliens intended. I'm absolutely convinced that in the vast majority of cases we're using sledgehammers to crack nuts. Nevertheless, some things we do apply. Spacels, bracelets that stimulate vital processes, all sorts of quasi-biological masses which cause such a revolution in medicine. We've gained new tranquilizers, new mineral fertilizers. We've revolutionized astronomy. In any case, why am I listing them? You know it all better than I do. I see you wear a bracelet yourself. Let us call this group of objects useful. You could say that to a certain extent, these objects have benefited humanity, although we can never forget that in our Euclidean world, every stick has two ends.
Undesirable applications, inserted Noonan.
Exactly. For example, applications of spacels in the defense industry.
Let's not get off track.
The behavior of each useful object has been more or less studied and more or less explained.
Right now, we're held back by technology, but in 50 years or so, we will learn how to manufacture these sledgehammers ourselves, and then we'll crack nuts with them to our heart's content. The story's more complicated with another group of objects, more complicated precisely because we can't find any application for them, and yet their properties, given our current theories, are completely inexplicable. For example, take the magnetic traps of various types. We know that they are magnetic traps. Panoff gave a very witty proof of that. But we don't know where the generator of such a strong magnetic field could be, nor understand the reason for its amazing stability. We don't understand a thing. We can only make up fantastic conjectures about properties of space which we've never even suspected before. Or the K23. What do you call those pretty black beads that are used for jewelry? Black sparks, said Noonan. Right. Black sparks. Good name. Well, you know their properties. If you shine a light at such a bead, the light will be emitted after a pause, and the length of the pause depends on the weight of the ball, its size, and a number of other parameters, while the frequency of the emitted light is always less than its original frequency. What does this mean? Why? There's an insane idea that these black sparks are actually vast expanses of space. Space with different properties from our own, which curled up into this form under the influence of our space. Valentine took out a cigarette and lit it. In short, the objects in this group are currently completely useless for human purposes, yet, from a purely scientific point of view, they have fundamental significance. These are miraculously received answers to questions we don't yet know how to pose. The aforementioned Sir Isaac mightn't have made sense of the microwave emitter, but he would have at any rate realized that such a thing was possible. And that would have had a very strong effect on his scientific worldview. I won't get into details, but the existence of such objects as the magnetic traps, the K23, and the white ring instantly disproved a number of recently thriving theories and gave rise to some entirely new ideas. And then there's also a third group.
Yes, said Noonan. Hell slime and other shit.
No. All those belong either to the first or the second group. I mean objects about which we either know nothing or have only hearsay information, objects which we've never held in our hands, ones that were carried off by the stalkers from under our noses, sold to God knows who, hidden, the ones they don't talk about, the legends and semi-legends, the wish machine, Dick the Tramp, happy ghosts.
Wait, said Noonan. What's all this? I understand the wish machine.
Valentine laughed. You see, we also have our work jargon. Dick the Tramp, that's the same hypothetical wind-up doll which is causing havoc in the ruins of the factory. And happy ghosts are a kind of dangerous turbulence that can happen in certain regions of the zone.
First I've heard of them, said Noonan.
You see, Richard, said Valentine, we've been digging through the zone for 2 decades, but we don't even know 1,000th part of what it contains. And if you count the zone's effect on man, by the way, we're going to have to add another 4th group to our classification, not of objects, but of effects. This group has been outrageously badly studied, even though, in my opinion, we've gathered more than enough data. And you know, Richard, I'm a physicist and therefore a skeptic, but sometimes even I get goosebumps when I think about this data.
Living corpses, muttered Noonan.
What? Oh, no, that's mysterious, but nothing more. How can I put it? It's conceivable, maybe. But when, for no reason at all, a person becomes surrounded by extra-physical, extra-biological phenomena...
Oh, you mean the emigrants?
Exactly. You know, statistics is a very precise science, despite the fact that it deals with random variables, and furthermore, it's a very eloquent science, very visual.
Valentine had apparently become tipsy. He was speaking louder, his cheeks had turned rosy, and the eyebrows above the dark glasses had risen high in his forehead, wrinkling his brow.
"Rosalie," he barked, "more cognac, a large shot."
"I like non-drinkers," said Noonan with respect.
"Don't get distracted," said Valentine strictly. "Listen to what I'm telling you. It's very strange." He picked up his glass, drank off half in one gulp, and continued. "We don't know what happened to the poor people of Harmont at the very moment of the visit, but now one of them has decided to emigrate, some ordinary resident, a barber. The son of a barber and the grandson of a barber. He moves to, say, Detroit, opens a barber shop, and all hell breaks loose. More than 90% of his clients die in the course of a year. They die in car accidents, fall out of windows, are cut down by gangsters and hooligans, drown in shallow places, and so on and so forth. Furthermore, the number of municipal disasters in Detroit increases sharply. The number of gas pump explosions jumps by a factor of 2. The number of fires caused by faulty wiring jumps by a factor of 3.5. The number of car accidents jumps by a factor of 3. The number of deaths from flu epidemics jumps by a factor of 2. Furthermore, the number of natural disasters in Detroit and its environs also increases. Tornadoes and typhoons, the likes of which haven't been seen in the area since the 1700s, make an appearance. The heavens open, and Lake Ontario, or Michigan, or wherever Detroit is, burst its banks. Well, and more to that effect, and the same cataclysms happen in any town, any region where an emigrant from the neighborhood of his own settles down, and the number of cataclysms is directly proportional to the number of emigrants that settle in that particular place. And note that this effect is only observed with emigrants who lived through the visit. Those who were born after the visit have no impact on the accident statistics. You've lived in Harmont for 10 years, but you moved here after the visit, and you could safely move to the Vatican itself. How do we explain this? What do we have to give up, statistics or common sense? Valentine grabbed the shot glass and drained it in one gulp. Richard Noonan scratched behind his ear. He said. "I've actually heard a lot about these things, but frankly, I've always assumed this was all, to put it mildly, a bit exaggerated. Someone just needed a pretext for banning immigration." Valentine smiled bitterly. "That's quite the pretext. Who would believe this lunacy? No. They'd make up an epidemic, a danger of spreading subversive rumors, anything but this." He put his elbows on the table and looked unhappy, burying his face in his hands. "I do sympathize," said Noonan. "You're right, from the point of view of our mighty positivist science. Or say, the mutations caused by the zone," interrupted Valentine. He took off his glasses and stared at Noonan with nearsighted dark eyes. "All people in contact with the zone for a sufficiently long time undergo changes, both in phenotype and in genotype. You know what stalkers' children are like. You know what happens with stalkers themselves. Why? What causes the mutations? There's no radiation in the zone. The chemical structure of the air and soil in the zone, though peculiar, poses no mutation risk. What am I supposed to do under these circumstances? Start to believe in witchcraft? In the evil eye? Listen, Richard, let's order another round. I've really gotten a taste for it, damn it." Richard Noonan, smirking, ordered another shot of cognac for the laureate and another beer for himself. Then he said, "All right. I am, of course, sympathetic to your turmoil. But to be honest, I personally find the reanimated corpses much more disturbing than your statistical data.
especially since I've never seen the data, but the corpses I've seen and smelled them too.
Valentine gave a careless wave. Oh, you and your corpses, he said. Listen, Richard, aren't you ashamed of yourself? After all, you're an educated man. Do you really not see that from the perspective of fundamental principles, these corpses of yours are neither more nor less astonishing than the perpetual batteries? It's just that the spacials violate the first principle of thermodynamics, and the corpses the second. That's the only difference. In some sense, we're all cavemen. We can't imagine anything more frightening than a ghost or a vampire, but the violation of the principle of causality, that's actually much scarier than a whole herd of ghosts, or Rubenstein's monsters, or is that Wallenstein? Frankenstein? Yes, of course, Mrs. Shelley, the poet's wife, or daughter. He suddenly laughed. These corpses of yours do have one curious property, autonomous viability. For example, you can cut off their leg and the leg will keep walking. Well, not actually walking, but in any case, living separately without any physiological salt solutions. Anyway, the Institute recently had a delivery of one of these unclaimed ones, so they prepared him. Boyd's lab assistant told me about it. They cut off his right hand for some experiments, came in the next morning, and saw... It's giving them the finger! Valentine laughed uproariously. Hmm. And it's still at it. It just keeps making a fist, then flipping them off. What do you figure it's trying to say?
I'd say the gesture is pretty transparent.
Isn't it time for us to go home, Valentine? Said Noonan, looking at his watch. I have another important errand to run.
All right, Valentine agreed enthusiastically, vainly attempting to stick his face into the frame of his glasses.
Oh, Richard, you've really gotten me drunk. He picked up his glasses with both hands and carefully hoisted them in place. You drove?
Yes, we'll drop you off.
They paid and headed toward the exit. Valentine held himself even straighter than usual and kept smacking his temple with his finger, greeting familiar lab assistants who were watching one of the leading lights of world science with curiosity and wonder. Right by the exit, greeting the grinning doorman, he knocked off his glasses and all three of them quickly rushed to catch them.
Ugh, Richard, Valentine kept repeating, climbing into the Peugeot. You got me shamelessly drunk. Not right, damn it. Awkward. I have an experiment tomorrow. You know, it's curious. And he launched into a description of the next day's experiment, constantly getting sidetracked by jokes and repeating, got me drunk. What a thing. Totally wasted. Noonan dropped him off in the science district, having decisively put down the laureate's sudden desire to top things off. What damn experiment? You know what I'm going to do with your experiment? I'm going to postpone it. And handed him over to his wife, who, upon observing her husband's condition, became highly indignant.
Guests? Rumbled the husband.
Who?
Ah, Professor Boyd. Excellent. Now we'll hit the bottle. No more shots, damn it. We'll drink by the cup. Richard, where are you, Richard?
Noonan heard this already running down the stairs. So they are scared too, he thought, again getting into his Peugeot. Scared. The eggheads. And maybe that's how it should be. They should be even more scared than the rest of us ordinary folks put together. Because we merely don't understand a thing, but they at least understand how much they don't understand. They gaze into this bottomless pit and know that they will inevitably have to climb down. Their hearts are racing, but they'll have to do it. Except they don't know how, or what awaits them at the bottom, or, more important, whether they'll ever be able to get back. Meanwhile, we sinners look the other way, so to speak. Listen, maybe that's how it should be. Let things take their course, and we'll muddle through somehow. He was right about that. Mankind's most impressive achievement is that it has survived and intends to continue doing so. Still, I hope you go to hell, he told the aliens. You couldn't have had your picnic somewhere else, on the moon, say, or on Mars. You are just callous assholes like the rest of them, even if you have learned to curl up space.
Had to have a picnic here, you see. A picnic. How can I best deal with my picnic, she thought, slowly navigating the Pujo along the brightly lit streets. What would be the most clever way to go about it? Using the principle of least action, like in mechanics. What's the damn point of my engineering degree if I can't even figure out a cunning way to catch that legless bastard? He parked the car in front of Redrick Schuhart's building and sat behind the wheel for a bit, thinking about how to conduct the conversation. He took out the spacel, climbed out of the car, and only then noticed that the building looked abandoned. Almost all the windows were dark, and there was no one in the park. Even the lights there weren't lit. That reminded him of what he was about to see, and he shuddered uncomfortably. It even crossed his mind that it might make sense to call Redrick up and ask him to meet him in the car or some quiet bar, but he chased the thought away for a number of reasons. Besides, he told himself, let me not become like those pitiful scum who have fled this place like rats from a sinking ship. He entered the building and slowly walked up the long, unswept stairs. All around him was a vacant silence. Most of the doors on the landings were ajar or even open wide. The dark entryways beyond them gave off a stale odor of dampness and dust. He stopped in front of the door to Redrick's apartment, smoothed down the hair behind his ears, sighed deeply, and rang the doorbell. For a while, there was no sound behind the door. Then the floorboards squeaked, the lock clicked, and the door softly opened. He never did hear footsteps. In the doorway stood the monkey, Redrick Schuhart's daughter. Bright light fell from the foyer into the dimly lit landing, and for a second Noonan only saw the girl's dark silhouette and thought how much she had grown in the past few months. But then she stepped farther back into the apartment, and he saw her face. His mouth immediately became dry. "Hello, Maria," he said, trying to speak as gently as possible. "How are you, monkey?" She didn't reply. She stayed quiet and silently backed up toward the door of the living room, glaring at him from beneath her brows. It looked like she didn't recognize him, but then, to be honest, he didn't recognize her either. The zone, he thought. Shit. "Who's there?" asked Gouda, peering out of the kitchen. "My God, Dick, where have you been hiding? You know, Redrick came back." She hurried toward him, wiping her hands on a towel thrown over her shoulder. The same good-looking, strong, energetic woman, except she seemed more haggard somehow. Her face had become drawn, and her eyes were feverish, maybe. He kissed her cheek, handed her his raincoat and hat, and said, I've heard, just couldn't pick a time to drop by. Is he home?" "Yeah," said Gouda. "There's someone over. He'll probably leave soon. They've been in there a while. Come in, Dick." He took a few steps along the hallway and stopped in the living room doorway. The old man was sitting behind the table, alone, motionless and listing slightly to one side. The pink light from the lampshade fell on the dark, wide face, as if carved from old wood, on the sunken, lipless mouth and on the fixed, vacant eyes, and immediately Noonan sensed the smell. He knew that it was just a freak of the imagination, that the smell only lasted the first few days and then disappeared without a trace, but Richard Noonan could sense it, as if with his memory, a damp, heavy smell of fresh earth. "Why don't we go into the kitchen?" Gouda asked hastily. "I'm cooking dinner. We can talk at the same time." "Of course," Noonan said brightly. "Haven't seen each other in ages. Do you still remember what I'd like to drink before dinner?" They went to the kitchen. Gouda immediately opened the fridge, and Noonan sat down at the table and looked around. As usual, everything in here was tidy. Everything sparkled, and there was steam rising from the pots. The stove was a new electric one, which meant there was money in the house. "Well, how is he?" "Same as always," answered Gouda. "He lost weight in jail, but he's already gained it back." "Red-headed?" I'll say. Mean? Of course, he'll take that to the grave. Gouda put a Bloody Mary in front of him. A clear layer of Russian vodka seemed to be suspended above a layer of tomato juice. Too much? She asked. Just the right amount. Noonan gathered air into his lungs and, screwing up his eyes, poured the mixture into his mouth. He remembered that this was basically the first real drink he'd had today. It's much better, he said. Now life is good. Everything okay with you? Asked Gouda. Why haven't you come by in so long? I've been damn busy, said Noonan. Every week I was planning to drop by or at least call, but first there was the trip to Rexopolis, then I had to deal with the scandal, then they told me Redrick came back. All right, I think. Why get in the way? Anyway, Gouda, I've been run off my feet. Sometimes I ask myself, why the hell are we always in such a whirl? For the money? But why in the world do we need money if all we ever do is keep working? Gouda clanged the pot lids, took a pack of cigarettes from the shelf, and sat across from Noonan. Her eyes were lowered. Noonan quickly snatched out a lighter and lit her cigarette, and, for the second time in his life, saw her hands shake. Like that time when Redrick had just been convicted, and Noonan came by to bring her money. At first, she was completely destitute, and the assholes in the building refused to lend her a cent. Eventually, the money did appear, and in all likelihood, a considerable sum, and Noonan could guess where it was from. But he continued to drop by, bringing the monkey toys and candy, spending whole evenings drinking coffee with Gouda, helping her plan Redrick's successful future life. Finally, getting his fill of her stories, he would go to the neighbors and try to somehow reason with them, explaining, cajoling, then finally losing his patience, threatening. You know, Red will come back. He'll break every bone in your body. Nothing helped. How's your girlfriend? Asked Gouda. Who? You know, the one you brought that time. The blonde. You thought that was my girlfriend? That was my stenographer. She got married and quit. You should get married, Dick, said Gouda. Want me to find you a wife? Noonan almost replied as usual, I'm waiting for the monkey, but stopped himself in time. It wouldn't have sounded right. I need a stenographer, not a wife, he grumbled. You should leave your red-headed devil and come work for me as a stenographer. I remember you are an excellent stenographer. Old Harris still remembers you. I'm sure he does, she said. I had a hell of a time fending him off. Is that how it was? Noonan pretended to be surprised. That Harris. My God, said Gouda, he wouldn't leave me alone. I was just afraid that Red would find out. The monkey silently appeared. She materialized in the doorway, looked at the pots, looked at Richard, then approached her mother and leaned against her, turning away her face. Well, monkey, Richard Noonan said heartily, want a chocolate? He dug into his vest pocket, took out a little chocolate car in a clear packet, and offered it to the girl. She didn't move. Gouda took the chocolate and put it on the table. Her lips suddenly turned white. Yes, Gouda, Noonan said, still cheery. I'm planning to move, you know. I'm sick of the hotel. First of all, it really is too far from the Institute. She almost doesn't understand anything anymore, said Gouda softly. And he cut himself off, picked up a glass with both hands, and started pointlessly spinning it in his fingers. I see that you don't ask how we are, she continued. And you're right not to. Except you're an old friend, Dick. We have no secrets from you. Not that we could keep it a secret. Have you seen a doctor? Asked Noonan without raising his eyes. Yes. They can't do a thing, and one of them said... She fell silent. He was silent, too. There was nothing to say here, and... He didn't want to think about it, but he was unexpectedly struck by an awful thought. It's an invasion, not a picnic, not a plea for contact, an invasion. They can't change us, but they infiltrate the bodies of our children and change them in their image. He shivered, but then he immediately remembered that he had already read something like that, some paperback with a bright, glossy cover, and the memory made him feel better. People imagined all sorts of things. In reality, nothing was ever the way people imagined.
And one of them said she's no longer human, continued Gouda.
Nonsense, Noonan said hollowly. You should see a real specialist. See James Catterfield. Want me to talk to him? I'll arrange an appointment.
You mean the butcher? She gave a nervous laugh. Thanks, Dick, but it's all right.